This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, venture capitalist, Virgin Galactic chairman, and Facebook veteran Chamath Palihapitiya describes the consumer conundrum in an economy hampered by coronavirus.
The best technology companies in the world have literally been training billions of consumers to not really spend money. The whole idea is if you wait, tomorrow you'll get more for less.
And why he doesn't think the moves of the central bank are enough.
Yeah, the Fed did calm the waters. Asset inflation does not solve income disparity. It actually doesn't solve full employment. It doesn't do any of the things we needed to do for it to be a robust economy.
Plus, social network author Ben Mesrick on the opportunities in staying at home.
What we're seeing is that people are all starting to live like hermits, like I always have.
It's Tuesday, May 12th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
First up on today's podcast, a special extended interview with Chamath Palihapitiya. He's the chairman of Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, which might be how you know him, or maybe his viral comments about the dangers of social media put him on the map for you.
I think the tools that have been created today are starting to erode the social fabric of how society works. Today we live in a world now where it is easy to confuse truth and popularity, and you can use money to amplify whatever you believe and get people to believe that what is popular is now truthful and what is not popular may not be truthful.
That was during another CNBC interview back in 2017. Chamath was on the early management team at Facebook until 2011, and he's been unabashedly vocal about media platforms and pretty much everything else ever since. He even criticized Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, in a passionate defense of Bitcoin earlier this year.
Warren Buffett says he has zero value, zero inherent value, unless someone pays more for it.
I think he's an exceptional person. I've learned an enormous amount, both from afar and the few interactions I've had with him. He is completely wrong and outdated on this.
For that very reason, Joe, Becky, and Andrew came prepared with a litany of questions for him this morning, from the economy to Tesla to income inequality during a pandemic. Chamath founded Social Capital, a venture capital firm committed to advancing humanity by solving the world's hardest problems. In that firm's portfolio, Slack, Box, SurveyMonkey, and others. He's also a board member and part owner of the Golden State Warriors, and he's based in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where Chamath Palihapitiya joined us from this morning on Squawk Box. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
I think where I want to start is the big news of today and what's become a debate, the Fed planning to buy up ETFs backed by bonds and what that means what do you think it says about our economy and what kind of debate you think there's going to be in this country about the steps the government's taking?
Well, I think that if there was any doubt before, there should be no doubt now that we have completely divorced the economy from the stock and the bond markets. And, you know, the Fed has been the principal agent of that obfuscation. And so, you know, what these guys are doing now is with the ballooning balance sheet and all of this money going into prop up companies, what you're going to start is a really bad, or you're going to accelerate a really bad deflationary super cycle here. So, you know, if you think about this, Andrew, like the best technology companies in the world have literally been training billions of consumers to not really spend money, right? The whole idea is if you wait, tomorrow you'll get more for less, whether that's YouTube or Facebook or Google or Amazon. The point is that these guys have really conditioned people that, you know, you on balance want to actually not be spending that much money because we'll just be giving you more and more value. And when you on top of that, then add to the fact that the Fed comes and pumps in all of this money that has to go someplace, consumers respond by picking these companies that give them more for less. That's where all the profits get trapped. As a result, a handful of companies really disproportionately perform and inflate the equity markets. The companies that actually traffic in traditional business models that don't necessarily have tech at their disposal get decimated. And so that cycle is just going to get exacerbated and exacerbated. So in the real world, things will continue to get cheaper for the future.
Chamath, though, here's the question. And I'm not advocating the Fed doesn't do these things because I don't think that there's many other options The problem is that it's a blunt instrument to a large degree. And while you'd love to make the stimulus, if you will, more effective or get it to the right people, we don't have a system of government that necessarily is at least can or is willing to do that.
Well, we have to figure out how to break this cycle of deflation. And when we're a debtor, when you are a debtor, the best thing for you is some form of inflation, or at least to minimize the effects of deflation. And the reality is that we do have a system, and you don't have to pick who the quote unquote right people are. The right people is every citizen of the United States. And I've said this before, but this is a point in time where direct fiscal stimulus should be going to the hands of U.S. taxpayers. It is the most effective way to blunt this unnecessarily rampant asset inflation in the markets and at least balance it with incentives in the hands of consumers to buy things. And if you don't break this cycle and teach a new pattern of behavior, we're going to be looking at a Japanese-style deflationary period where we'll have 10 years of unemployment, the economy will just be stagnant, and we'll wonder why equity markets keep going to all-time highs when it doesn't actually map to what you see in the real world on a day-to-day basis.
I want to touch on so many different issues with you. One of the other hot topics of the morning is what's going on with a company that I know you like a lot, which is Tesla and Elon Musk. Is Elon Musk doing the right thing by opening in the face of rules in Alameda that would effectively tell him that he can't?
Yeah, I think this case is so interesting because it actually paints what you guys spoke about before. I have been and will continue to be a huge supporter of his. What you have right now is this issue where the federal government has a specific set of guidelines. People may think that they fall into those guidelines. Then states then issue guidelines. And then on top of that, you have regulations at local levels. When you put them all together, it's incredibly confusing. So if you're a business owner and you're trying to figure out how to get back to work because you believe the risks are manageable, there is no clear way that you can go and actually get the approvals to do so. Because if the federal government says yes and the state government says yes, but then a local government says no, what are you to do? And then what are you supposed to do for your workers? So this is an issue where if you take a step back, what it says is there's still so much we don't understand about the virus. All this regulation is actually quite confusing. These local, state, and federal agencies have a responsibility to Americans to figure this out and be coherent. And otherwise, you'll have all of this disparity where on one side, people think we should be closed until there's a vaccine. On the other side, thousands of workers are clamoring to get back to work because of their livelihood, and there's no coherent policy response. That's unfortunately where we are, and I empathize with this position.
Chamath, that's the policy issue. My question to you is, do you support Elon Musk saying local laws be damned in this case? I'm moving ahead.
I don't think he's saying local laws be damned. I think he was trying to actually get time with the folks in Alameda. And frankly, what I saw on Twitter was, you know, basically literally somebody telling him to F off. It was not the kind of discourse you'd expect from public officials who are responsible for engaging with local business owners. So I think what I'm saying explicitly is Alameda should sit down with Tesla, have them walk through their entire testing mechanism, the protocols they're taking, and actually make a decision and not fight him over Twitter.
Hey, Chamath, I wanted to go back just to the point on the Fed. Look, I realize that it's ugly and that it's not the perfect way of doing things, but I think if the Fed hadn't done what it did 2 months ago to kind of step in and stabilize the markets, we'd be in a much worse position today, because by stabilizing, let's say, the credit markets, companies that are good, strong, conservative companies were able to go to the market and borrow money and make sure that they're going to have enough money to get through the tough times to come. And as a result, they'll be able to keep their employees on. You think back to the financial crisis that we faced in 2008 and 2009, where there were serious questions about a company like GE being able to make payroll. If you saw big companies not get access to credit and not get access to money that they needed from private investors, I think we'd be in a much worse position. I can understand your point about thinking there are a lot of people who still need help along the way, but I just feel like things would be much worse if the Fed hadn't taken those actions.
Well, I take your point, and here's what I would say. I would say that 90% of the gains actually happened when the Fed just signaled that they were going to do something. You're absolutely right. It calmed the markets down enough where the best companies could go and actually get the capital that they needed. But then if you actually separate it and look at it now, the Fed's primary and secondary facilities aren't necessarily going to affect or help the best companies. Because in order to sort of qualify for these programs, you need to go through a whole bunch of hoops. You need to sign up for, supervision on executive compensation. You are going to self-select, at least in their primary facility, for probably the worst performing companies. And when you go and buy ETFs, you're buying baskets of things that also contain a bunch of these zombie companies. The best companies can and will continue to self-finance in the markets by themselves. And yeah, you're right, the Fed did calm the waters. But by now actually stepping in and spending more and injecting more capital, what you're going to see is the equity markets rip higher. You're going to see the credit markets continue to basically go towards negative rates. And none of that stuff does anything to actually fix the economy. And so asset inflation, we learned this from 2008 to now. Asset inflation does not solve income disparity. It actually doesn't solve full employment. It doesn't do any of the things we needed to do for it to be a robust economy. What it does is allow people who play in the financial markets to make money. Those don't trickle down to normal people. And until we actually admit that to ourselves, and until we realize that this dogmatic idea that inflation is bad, that's a dated idea, we're not going to move forward. And so I appreciate the fact that the Fed did something. I think it was critical. I think it was great that they said it. But now actually acting and pumping in all of this money on top of the money that's already gone in is creating a deflationary supercycle in the United States that is not helpful. Consumers are not going to spend. Hey, they are going to save. They're going to wait.
Chamath, buybacks. You have been a critic of buybacks recently. And yet Warren Buffett made an interesting comment at his annual meeting just about a week ago to Becky, I believe, where he effectively said there's nothing immoral about buybacks.
It should be needs sensitive, obviously, but when the conditions are right, it should also be obvious to repurchase shares, and there shouldn't be the slightest taint to it any more than there is to dividends. And people that have now sort of taken up the cries about how terrible it was that companies bought back stock. Well, you can say it was terrible for them to pay dividends, too. Then they'd have more money now. But they were doing what was intelligent at the time, and I hope they continue to do what's intelligent as they go forth.
Do you agree or disagree with Warren?
Yeah, it is a fundamentally idiotic business practice, and I agree with that. It is for the CEO who is unimaginative and has no idea what to do and is largely held hostage by hedge funds or their board. A third of S&P companies spend on R&D, only one third. So that means, 66 out of 100 companies don't even bother to think about tomorrow. They just take all the money they have and they just send it right out the door. And that kind of behavior is fundamentally dumb. Because when you go through a pandemic like this, what you realize is that you should have been building for some resiliency so that you would have savings, so that you can actually keep your employees through a drought, so that you can actually have business models that keep you in business, that can still generate revenue. But because you didn't do it, you're now all of a sudden standing at the till asking for a handout from the U.S. taxpayer, whereas the U.S. taxpayer themselves can't get any help. So that dynamic needs to get fixed. And the simple way to do it is to actually have a checklist. So to basically say, before you are allowed to do a buyback, there are certain things that you should be doing. You should be spending on R&D. You shouldn't be compensating your CEO 600 times, the lowest employee in your company. There are all kinds of simple checks and balances. After 2008, we asked the banks to do this. And we said, let's clean up and give health checks to these banks before we allow them to lever up and sort of, push us into an abyss the way that they did in 2008. Coming out of 2020, I think what we should realize is we have a very brittle economy, a very fragile ecosystem of companies that are overlevered. We need to create incentives for these folks to save and to invest in the future. And the best way to do it is to not allow them to take the short-term, easy way out. When you look at Amazon, what's interesting about Amazon is people used to lambast Jeff Bezos for not being profitable. But when you looked under the hood, he was the single best investor of our generation, even better than Buffett, because he would take billions of dollars of free cash flow and invest it in the future. There is a business case to be made in every company to either save and or spend to plan for the future. And instead to just give it back randomly in the open market is one of the dumbest business decisions you can make. So Warren is right, and I agree with him.
And I understand exactly where you're coming from, although I do think, as a guy who loves risk capital, if a company is like some staid company that has too much cash, and I don't think Apple was staid necessarily, but if they give it back to shareholders who then go out and redeploy it into technology companies or somewhere else, I don't think it's necessarily should be viewed in a negative light. But you know what I really want to talk to you about? But you can talk about this, but I want to talk to you about whether we ever go watch the Warriors play again. And whether, do you wish you had sold the Warriors before all this happened? Or no, you're in it to win it, and we'll get through this. I mean, I'm sure that that's the answer I want to hear. But we're going to get through this, right? And play some more hoops someday?
Let me say two things. But first, on the first one, I think, again, the key part of Warren's sentence is under the right conditions. And all
right.
I'm saying, Jim, is
I agree.
You don't send the money out the door before you take care of yourself and invest for your own future. That's
okay.
All I'm saying.
I got
and
it.
When that's possible, you should do it. And most of these CEOs have not. And I think that's ridiculous when they then go and ask for money.
Chamath, they got a level. You know, it's bad. But from the last time we did this, we didn't want cash compensation. We want them to have a stake in the company. So they try to shrink the float, to raise the EPS, to get the stock price up to where some of their compensation kicks in. And I understand that. And it's the unintended consequences of what we did last time. So, but I do understand. How about? Am I going to be able to sit on the floor and it's going to be just me and you if I come out there?
I think this is a really important question we need to figure out. The reality is, in my opinion, there are certain experiences, going out to eat, going to concerts, going into large areas where you have basically anonymous interactions, essentially. So stadiums, casinos, I think, frankly, cruise ships. These are all the last things that can come online, because you're taking a level of risk where you have to underwrite your own comfort. And that's not something that we've ever had to do before. You know, it's not as if when you got on an airplane, there was a 50-50 chance that something could happen. The reality is these were, 99.99999% safe. And so flying across the country was just the thing you did. But if you know, going to see a concert all of a sudden was 50-50 or 60-40 or 70-30, for some people, those risks will be okay, probably the younger you are. And the older you are, those risks shouldn't be okay, frankly. So I think that these are things that are going to be the longest things to figure out. And you're going to see some unfortunate byproducts of this. You may see college football stadiums empty for the next 2 years. Or you may see people separated, by 10 or 12 seats, which what kind of an experience is that? I don't know. So I don't know the answer. I don't know what the NBA is planning to do specifically. But if you're asking me just as a person that manages risk, I wouldn't be super comfortable taking a huge risk going into, a casino floor or, going to a concert for the foreseeable future.
It is true, and it's not enough time with you. We had Paul Tudor Jones on yesterday, and he was talking about, QE infinity, however you want to look at it, and that maybe the time will come when you need to have some type of asset that there's a fixed amount of. And he was referring to Bitcoin.
Here it comes.
So I think maybe even Paul Tudor Jones.
Say the words. Say the
Bitcoin.
Words.
I have to disclose that I own, compared to you, I own like 3 cents out of a dollar or something. You know what I mean? But I have to disclose that I own it. But Paul Tudor Jones made the case yesterday. And, yesterday was the halvening. The halvening was yesterday. So the stock to flow has now gone up.
Joe, this is again, now you're seeing a lot of lines of different thinking converge. So when we started to believe in the long-term value of Bitcoin, it was as a store of value, and it was that schmuck insurance that you kept under the mattress. And there was a small cohort of us that have believed this for like almost the last 10 years now. But when you have people like Paul Tudor Jones, sophisticated market participants, who don't necessarily come to it from that perspective because he was probably first in gold or, curve steepeners or whatever, now all of a sudden even he is looking at Bitcoin. And the reason is because we are in this massive deflationary spiral. And you have to figure out how to protect yourself. And so however you think about it, from a classic economic theory or the schmuck insurance where you're somewhat skeptical of the, you know, established governing masses, it is important that we have a hedge, a non-correlated hedge. And I still struggle to find anything that is as uncorrelated to anything else and to everything else than Bitcoin. And I think that, you know, if we see it have its day, it's a moment where you're going to wish that you had just bought the 1% and just kept it.
Yeah. One man's 1% is another man's. Anyway, it's been great having you on, Chamath. And we all, I don't know.
I'm ready for
Russian table tennis. I got some. There's one guy I got to tell you about. He's so good. You got to bet on him. That's all we have. It's horrible. I can't wait for sports to come back. I just want to do it safely. And I know you probably feel the same way. Thanks, Chamath. See ya.
Next on Squawk Pod, author Ben Mezrich, who writes about the quickly changing worlds of social media and cryptocurrency, on the innovation of staying in.
People are stuck at home and finding new ways to consume stories. So I think this is the dawning of all of these streamers that were exploding right before this. Now they're going to take over.
We're back after this. You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC. The coronavirus outbreak is feeding into the stay-at-home economy. Companies that provide entertainment, necessary goods and services, or allow employees to work remotely are only going to and have already been benefiting. Today, we were joined by best-selling author and self-identified hermit, Ben Mezrich. Ben has teamed up exclusively with the Boston Globe to publish his new novella, The Mechanic, in serialized form. In a throwback format made popular by Charles Dickens, the novella will run in chapters from May 3rd through May 17th, exclusively with the Boston Globe in print, remember that, and online. Ben Mezrich has a long list of bestsellers, including Bitcoin Billionaires, The Social Network, you might have seen the movie, and Bringing Down the House. And in an eerie coincidence, back in 2015, he published a fictional novella titled Q, about a coronavirus striking New York City, forcing the Big Apple into quarantine. Here's Becky Quick with Ben Mezrich.
You know, you have been behind so many of the trends that we've watched, everything from Facebook kind of watching that take off, Bitcoin watching that pick up. You've got your finger on the pulse for how people live, how people work, and how some of those changes kind of take place. Obviously, this is new for all of us, but what do you see happening as we continue to shelter at home?
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing is that people are all starting to live like hermits, like I always have. I think that streamers are enormous. I mean, we're spending all of our time watching as much as we can. We're consuming, like we don't want to go outside anymore. So things like streamers are going crazy. Online is going crazy. I've been writing this story in the Boston Globe. So I'm basically writing a book that's published in chapters every day in the Boston Globe, and tons of people are reading it, which, I want to believe is because I'm such a great writer, but is also because people are stuck at home and finding new ways to consume stories. So I think this is the dawning of all of these streamers that were exploding right before this. Now they're going to take over.
You know, Ben, I wonder, obviously, what you're writing is getting huge pickup, and people do appreciate having this and having a new way to do it because all of our lives have changed. But I don't think that the new routine that I have is necessarily one that's going to be here for forever. Maybe this last 3 months, maybe it lasts six, maybe it even lasts 12 to 18, if you believe what some epidemiologists have said. But I do feel like eventually we get back to a more normal. I appreciate the slower pace of life, but I don't know if I can completely control that once regular life resumes.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, when things get back to normal or a little more normal, are you going to go to a movie theater? Are you going to, have 10 people over your living room to watch something? Or are you going to be more likely to watch something and communicate through your phone or communicate through your computer or something like that? I do think, you know, there's this urge and this want to go back out and see people. But at the same time, some of the things like watching whatever you want, when you want, over and over again is going to stay with us. I really think that the streamers are going to become more and more and more part of our lives. The question is, how are they going to maintain if we're stuck like this for longer than a few more months? Because they got to start producing more content, and it's very, very hard for them to do. But I think certain things are going to stay. And I do think more and more we're going to, you know, like my kids watch a movie with all of their friends and they're loving it. The idea that they can do this from their home and text with each other on the computer screen while they're doing it with one of these watch parties, this is not going to go away. These watch parties are going to become part of their lives.
What does that mean for the big media conglomerates, the big companies that have so much money invested in the way things work?
I mean, I think there's going to be a mix, but I do think that they're going to have to, you know, start figuring out ways to produce more and more content for these streamers. I think the streamers are going to be in a massive battle for eyeballs, and they're only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, it's the same thing, like, you know, you're ordering everything from Amazon, you're ordering everything from, you know, wherever you can at home. You're going to want to be able to order everything you want to watch. You know, when that movie, was it Sonic or whatever it was, came on TV, every single kid watched it. And I think that this is going to be a battle between movie theaters going forward and streaming at home. That's gonna go in the favor of the streamers, I think.
I see your book, Bitcoin Billionaires, behind you. Have you spoken with the Winklevi twins, the Winklevoss twins?
I love the Winklevi twins.
Everything came into the pandemic?
Yeah, so we've just had the big halving, right? So the Bitcoin halving was a big, big moment in Bitcoin history. I speak to the Winklevi all the time. Those guys are amazing people. I think they're doing well with it. And Bitcoin, you know, skyrocketed. And so they're doing better and better, I think.
You think that they've doubled down and they're still everything in Bitcoin?
They're big believers in where Bitcoin can go. And I think Bitcoin makes a lot of sense in a time like this, because we don't really know what's going to go on with the economy outside. But we do know that Bitcoin has just become a little more scarce. So you would think going forward that Bitcoin would go up from here. They're big believers in it as part of our future and a big part of our financial system. So they're long, they're hodlers. They're those guys. Yeah.
Well, Ben, want to thank you for being with us this morning and for riding the mechanic, keeping people entertained through all of this and continuing to roll with this. It's good to see you.
Thank you. I hope people keep reading. Appreciate it.
Squawk Pod will be right back. And that's the show for today. Thank you for listening today and every day. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, catch us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever, every day. And if you don't already, please subscribe to Squawk Pod and tell your friends, colleagues, family members, maybe on your next group Zoom. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.